for all of us in God's church. And someone recently asked me, why do you think God allowed Mr. Dick King to die? I said, that's a good question. A good question we should all ask ourselves. Dick is relatively young, 73 years of age. Been struggling with cancer since, as I can recall, he was diagnosed back in 2009, I believe. In 2010, when Linda and I moved to Reading from Cincinnati, Ohio, he told me that he had been diagnosed with prostate cancer and that he was making decisions not to seek treatment. And I said, you know, there may be consequences for that. And he said, yes, I know, but I'm prepared to live with the consequences. And that's what we have seen played out, I think, these now, what, 7 years later? As we know, sometimes these things take time to develop in the human body. I'd like to turn to Isaiah 57, verse 1. Isaiah 57, verse 1, to introduce my message for the afternoon, because I think it is appropriate for us to slow down and to take stock of our own lives in the shadow or the context of the death of someone we all love and have respected. Isaiah 57, verse 1. The righteous perishes, and no man takes it to heart. We all recognize that one of our fellow Christian soldiers fell in this battle, but do we think about it? As I told this person who said, why did God allow him to die? I said, good question. Something we should all think about. Put in our own hearts. The question is answered by the prophet. Merciful men are taken away, while no one considers that the righteous is taken away from evil, the evil to come. And certainly I do believe, as we see prophecy unfolding, a leaf at a time in the book of prophecy, the days will be increasingly evil. The stresses in your life and my life will increase. The challenges of parenting will increase. Life will go on and prophecy will march on. We don't know what this next year will bring, do we? Just as those poor people in, you know, the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood Airport didn't know what was happening. They thought they were just going to collect their luggage and walk out of the airport into the arms of their loved ones. Didn't happen that way for at least, what was it, five of them who lost their lives, and eight more in the hospital, some struggling, as I heard in the news last night, to survive. We never know, do we? Life is indeed very fragile, and there are evil things to come as terrorism spreads, as diseases break out, as more tensions politically are created in the world, perhaps even at the nuclear level. I mean, we all live under that evil, don't we? Threats going back and forth, and missiles developed that can threaten additional nations and continents. Who knows what God has spared Dick from that you and I may have to see and suffer through. But God knows. And he says very clearly, merciful men are taken away, while no one considers that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. I think most of us are mature enough to know that these are the cycles of life. No man, no matter how righteous, no matter how dedicated, no how much a servant of God, has survived the grim reaper. Have they? Which one of the apostles has survived to this day? They all died. In fact, all but one of them died a martyr's death. a painful death, a tragic death. Linda and I were kind of surprised a few years ago. We had the opportunity to visit Cairo. And in the city of Cairo, there's the Egyptian Coptic Church. And Christians in Egypt make up less than 2% of the population. So they're definitely a minority. I think it was about 3 months ago there was a terrorist bombing outside the Coptic Church in Cairo. They're seen as a minority. They're looked down upon by Muslims in the country, especially extremists. And it's kind of interesting that they proudly display their Christianity. We went to a marketplace right next to the Coptic Church, and we saw the ladies who were dressed very conservatively, scarves over their heads, much like Muslim women. But when they raise their hands like this, you can see a tattoo of a cross on the inside of their hands, right on their wrist. You know, they openly are not ashamed to display, even though there are 2% of the population, that they are Christian. Now, they're not Christian in the same definition you and I are in. They're more after the tradition of the Eastern Church, the Greek Church, or the church in Istanbul. But they'll put that cross, they'll tattoo that on their wrist. So when they raise their hand, you can say, oh, she's not a Muslim. He's not a Muslim. He's a Christian, Coptic Christian, which is kind of interesting. But I was getting to a point, wasn't I? And I forgot what I was going to talk about for a second there. What was it in Cairo? I've lost it. Okay, let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Sorry. Talking about the cycles of life, Ecclesiastes 1. Boy, that thought completely escaped me. I got engrossed in my story and I forgot what I was going to make a point about. Ecclesiastes 1, verse 3 is where I'd like to read. I'll remind myself in a moment and get back to it, I promise. As I said, the ministry is aging. Ecclesiastes 1, verse 3. What profit has a man from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? Solomon, who is credited with writing Ecclesiastes, lived a very full and rich life, we all know. He enjoyed all of the hedonistic pleasures of life beyond what naturally would be experienced by any man. And some of the things he wrote towards the end of his life, like Ecclesiastes, express the frustration of the physical life. He writes here, what profit has a man from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? Most of us spend 50, 60 years working. What do we get out of it? Small pension, savings account, a house, an automobile. When we retire, and a lot of us are that age, we're thinking about retirement, although I don't think I'll ever retire. What do we have at the end of that life? What is the footprint that we've left? How deep is it? Our own president is thinking about that now. You can hear that reflected in the speeches of Michelle Obama and Barack Obama. They know they're leaving office. He wants to, you know, he wants to hang on to his legacy. He talks about that. I want to hang on to some of the programs, some of the laws that I initiated and brought into being, like Obamacare, as we call it, or the Affordable Care Act. He wants that to be preserved. And yet, of course, the opposing party, they want to get rid of it, as we all know. I mean, it's played out before us every day. He's worried about his legacy. What's going to be left of his 8 years as president? Verse 4 describes the cycle of life. One generation passes away and another generation comes. But the earth abides forever. We all understand the cycle of life, don't we? Because we've all experienced it, we've all lived it, we've had loved ones who've grown old and died, some have died prematurely. We understand the cycles of life and death. It is part of life, this human life that God has given us, we are all temporary, and we know how temporary that is, don't we? We're walking a fine line. You know, none of us knew a month ago that Sam, who was sitting with us in our congregation, would have a stroke. It's almost unpredictable. How do you know it's going to happen? Even the doctors who gave him previous CAT scans couldn't predict that he would have a stroke. But one day, Tess couldn't wake him up. She thought he was just sleeping really well, so she went to work. And the nurse that was there said, "I can't wake him up." So she came home at noon. She tried to wake him up, couldn't wake him up. She called me. I said, "You better call an ambulance if you can't wake him up." And that's when they discovered he had a stroke. But we couldn't have predicted that. Life is very fragile, isn't it? One generation passes away and another generation comes. But the earth abides forever. Life and death then is a natural part of the cycle of life. Notice in chapter 2, verse 17, there's a lot of rich wisdom about the cycles of life and death here. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 17. "Therefore," this is because I understood this life is temporary and it's a big cycle, and you grow old and you sometimes get infirmed or you grow weaker. He says, "Therefore I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me. For all is vanity," or temporary, "and grasping for wind." When I read that verse, and it's repeated several times in Ecclesiastes especially, I think of somebody standing in a field. Linda and I came across the causeway that comes through the Delta on Highway 12, and you can see these fields all around you. We like to come that way because it's peaceful. We're around freeways all week long, and so it's kind of nice to drive through a peaceful field. And the wind was blowing today. And you could see, the crops that are there, what was left of the crops, are kind of bending over in the wind and slashing back and forth in the breezes. And I could imagine a man, as I was thinking about this verse, standing out there in the middle of that field with a butterfly net. And the wind is coming and he's swishing that net in the air back and forth trying to catch the wind. We've heard that expression, "Can you catch the wind?" Now, I'm a sailor. I like sailing, and I have sailed before. And you can literally catch the wind in a sail to help drive you in a sailboat. But what he's describing here is like this guy in the middle of a field with a butterfly net, trying to catch the wind. You can't do it. To him, that's what life was like, a grasping for the wind. Verse 18, "Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me." And of course, we know what happened to Solomon's kingdom, the golden age of Israel. The kingdom was split after his death. A stranger took the bulk of the nation of Israel, the northern 10 tribes, and went into idolatry and established, his kingdom in the north up in Dan. And they almost immediately switched the Feast of Tabernacles and started doing things that he thought would appeal to the base, the people, and draw them in. He made priests of the basest of the people, it says, what Jeroboam did. And his own son, Rehoboam, was challenging enough too, right? It was a sad day, and he saw it coming. He said, "You work all your life to build things," like he built the temple, and he thought, "What's going to happen to this temple?" The words, I'm going to turn there, but the words of Moses are ringing in my ear, He said to the people, he said, "Draw the elders together." He says, "I know what's going to happen after my death." He says, "You're going to drift away from God, and you're going to fall into idolatry." And I'm sure all the elders were going, "Oh no, we've seen the great miracles of God. We would not do that." But what did they do? I sat in an auditorium in Pasadena, California, and I heard Mr. Armstrong say almost the same words. He says, "Brethren, don't do that." And it was scarcely, 10, 15 years after his death? They did exactly that, what he warned against. Solomon knew that. Verse 18, when one generation passes away, another comes, they don't appreciate what has gone on before. You know, Kevin talked about the generations in God's church. I, too, am a third generation Christian. And I have to struggle to hang on to my faith. All of you do too, right? We all have to struggle to hang on to our faith. But each generation removed from the pioneering generation, I mean, history tells us this, they grow more apathetic, generally speaking. Doesn't happen in all cases. And something we need to guard against. And I think Solomon saw that his own kingdom was going to begin to dissolve after his death. Let's drop down to verse 21. Ecclesiastes 2:21. For there's a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. Probably talking about himself. Doesn't matter how much wisdom you have, how much knowledge you have, how much skill you develop in your lifetime. Yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all of his labor, and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful, his work burdensome, even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is temporary. Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. Enjoy the day in which we live, take every advantage of it, and above all else, as we will discover, the conclusion of the matter is make sure we develop our relationship with God, because that's the only thing that will last. Everything else we have in our bank accounts, in our driveways, on our property, will be gone when we die. Can't use it. The Egyptians tried to, didn't they? Dig down in those crypts and you find that they wanted to take the boat so they could get across the river to eternal life. Many of them had their servants all killed when they died so that they could have servants and were buried with them. Their treasure, their favorite animals were mummified. They found mummified cats and dogs, their pets, so they could have their favorite pet in the new world. They thought they could take it with them. And today it's in a museum as a testimony to their foolishness, frankly. Let's go to Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 10. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. Nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. Isn't that true? Seems like the more you have, the more you want. I really saw this played out. My aunt died about 3-4 weeks ago. And my nieces asked me to come to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and conduct a funeral. But my aunt rebelled from her father, who was a Pentecostal minister, and became an atheist. And she married a very successful man. He ended up being the president of a mining company, a silver mine outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico. He died about 6 years ago, but over the years they collected a lot of silver. They had a safe in their house full of silver bars. Now, I didn't get a chance to see it, but I heard all the background chatter that was going on between the nieces, because he left his estate, and of course my aunt left her estate. Everything went to the two nieces. Now, one of the nieces is a computer programmer that lives in Chicago, who's, I would say, she's well off. During the course of the discussion, I found out from the other niece, who's a registered nurse, that the niece that's the computer engineer makes between $300,000 and $400,000 a year. Now, that, in my estimation, that's a pretty good income, right? I think everybody here says, yeah, that's pretty good. Well, it was kind of interesting to hear her argue with my other niece about how much of the estate, and she wanted the bulk of the estate, and how she was going to get that silver back to Chicago. She was complaining about this. All that silver, and I got to get that back to Chicago. I wasn't going to volunteer, you know, but obviously my rich aunt didn't remember, you know, her poor nephew on this side of the family. The only thing they wanted me to do was preach a funeral for an atheist, but they didn't want me to use the Bible, which was the first time I've ever done that, is to preach a funeral without referring to any scriptures. But I managed to get some scriptures in the closing prayer, you know, the internment prayer. But it is amazing, at funerals, people then, their claws come out. You know, this is the time everybody argues about who gets what in the estate. And that's sometimes the meanest, nastiest side of people that comes out, is in the wake of dividing resources after a person dies. And I think the wisdom of Solomon saw that. That's why he wrote what he did at Ecclesiastes. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. Verse 11. So what profit has the owners except to see them with their eyes while they've got them? I'm sure the president of that mining company, my uncle by marriage, probably opened that safe once in a while and felt the silver bars. I'm not suggesting silver is not a bad investment. It might be. I mean, I'm not an investment counselor. It may be a good investment. But I'm sure he felt those silver bars, put them back in his safe, closed the lid, locked down the combination again, and maybe, I don't know how often he did it, maybe a couple weeks later, you know, I'm imagining Scrooge in the cartoons, you know, going back to the safe and kind of feeling the silver bars and sticking them back in there and closing it down. Ah, I've got silver! You know, a hedge against inflation or a hedge against whatever happens in the future. And at some point, it may be helpful. I'm not suggesting it's not, but it's almost to the hurt of the person who has those kind of assets. As he says here in Ecclesiastes. Verse 12, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet. Somebody who works hard with their hands and their back, they sleep well, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man will not allow him to sleep. Remember the story of J. Paul Getty? One of the richest men in the world decided to put a payphone in his house because when his friends came over, they used his telephone to make long distance calls. He didn't like that. Kind of crazy, isn't it? Verse 13, there is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept to their owners' hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. When we die, we have no consciousness. We're not aware of all that we've done or collected or saved or provided for our children. They take it if you've provided for your children. And, of course, the biblical example is provide for your children's children. So that concept is important. And, you know, Linda and I have a trust. And, you know, we're leaving the small amount that we may have at the end of our lives to our children and our grandchildren. I think that's a biblical principle. I still remember one lady that was on one of our travel tours with us. She was in her 80s. She's still living. We see her on Facebook. She's getting close to 90 now, but she's very active. She took care of her husband who was dying for many, many years. Then she took care of her mother who was dying. And when her mother died, she left her a lot of money. I don't know how much, but it was sufficient. She could spend it capriciously. And I remember what she told us. She said, "You know, I'm on these trips because when my mother died, she left me all this money and told me to enjoy life. And I talked to my son, and my son said, 'Mom, I want your last check to bounce.'" So she said, "I took that my son wanted me to spend his inheritance." So she said, "Here I am. I'm traveling around the world. I'm going to these places I've always wanted to go, and I'm spending my kids' inheritance." And I said, "Well, if your son gave you permission, you know, that's great." And she still travels. She's into her... Oh, she's not? She doesn't travel anymore? Oh, she dead? Oh, okay. Thanks for the update. I'd forgotten, but I still remember that example on our trips that she was out there spending her kids' inheritance. And I thought, what a beautiful thing for her son to say, "Mom, I want your last check to bounce." Verse 16, "And this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go." We came into the world wearing nothing, and we go out that way, right? "And what profit has he who has labored for the wind all his days? He also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger." Here's what I've seen, verse 18. "It is good and fitting for one to eat, to drink, to enjoy the good of all of his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for that's his heritage." Enjoy, eat and drink. Enjoy each other's company. Enjoy life. But as we will learn, there's something more important than just enjoyment of life, which I think Solomon focused on too much in his lifetime. And I think his life witnesses that. Let's go to chapter 9. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 2. Ecclesiastes 9, 2. "All things come alike to all." Ecclesiastes 9:2. "One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and to him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath as he who fears an oath." This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. "Truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after they go to the dead. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die." We all academically know we will die, but you know, as Americans, we don't like to talk about death. In fact, per capita, I think we're the ones in the entire world, in our culture, that probably doesn't want to think about it, and therefore, as we grow older, we don't properly prepare. We don't have wills. We don't have trusts. We don't tell everybody what we want to happen, so at a funeral, there's a big firefight, you know? Who gets what? We just don't like to talk about death. It was kind of interesting living with Linda's mom for 8 years. Linda's mother was Japanese, and she came from a Japanese culture, and the Japanese talk about death all the time. Every time she caught a cold, you'd hear the same speech. It always began with, "When I die," and she'd sometimes call Linda into her bedside to take down, you know, to remind Linda where she wanted everything of hers to go. Which kid got what? Which was kind of interesting. Their culture talks about death all the time. Ours doesn't, does it? I'll tell you, until I was about 50, I really never noticed the obituaries in the newspaper. You ever notice that? You get to a certain point in your life and you start to feel your mortality. And the reason I felt is when I got to be 50, in the afternoons I started losing my energy and I felt real puny and I needed a nap every afternoon. I thought, what is happening? So I did the worst possible thing you could do. I went online and started self-diagnosing, you know. And I became convinced I was dying of leukemia. I looked at every bruise on my arm, thought, oh no, I'm bruising, I'm tired in the afternoon, I've got leukemia, oh no. So then I began reading the obituaries. And I noticed that there were not very many people who died in their 50s, but quite a few more in their 60s and 70s, and occasionally 80s and 90s, and even, you know, centenarians you'd find die once in a while. And it was kind of a crazy thing. I said, I'm reading the obituaries. I've never done this in my life. Because you begin to realize your mortality at a certain point. And I finally smartened up and went to a doctor, and he did a blood test and found out that I didn't have leukemia, thankfully. My thyroid was under-functioning, and so he gave me a little medication, which I've taken for the last 20 years, and my energy levels have come back, you know, and been maintained. It was just what they call a hypothyroid condition. And I found out my mother and my grandmother had it, so it was one of those wonderful things they passed down to me. Like most of us have things that our parents and grandparents passed to us, you know, kind of family-inherited things. But maybe you're at that age, you look at the obituary in the newspaper. And you go, boy, they were young. Wow, were they young. And you know what I've learned now that I'm getting older is that my definition of young, you know, the standard always rises. You know that? The other day someone asked me how old Dick was when he died. I said he was 73. And they said, wow, he was young. And I guess our standard in the United States now with our medical care, we think 73, yeah, that's relatively young. I'm getting far afield with my stories again. Let's go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Drop down to verse 7. Go, eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white. Now he gets into the moral lesson of what this life is about. Let your garments always be white. White robes, righteous behavior, character. Let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, temporary life, which he has given you under the sun and all your days of vanity. For that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. Which basically describes what we define as death. It's asleep. There's no knowledge, no work, no device, no wisdom in the grave. We will know nothing. I think we all understand that. Let's jump over to chapter 12, Ecclesiastes 12 at verse 7. Then the dust from which man has been made will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. The seal of what God has built in us will be preserved by God to be reunited at a future time with a different body, as we all know, a spirit body. You know, I've been asked on occasion about somebody who has dementia, and my own grandmother, who was a member of the church, spent about the last 5 years of her life. She lived into her mid-90s in a nursing home. But, you know, at some point she had a loss of short-term memory, and she thought of herself as a child. That's the way she thought of herself. She was like 5 or 6 years old. and she didn't recognize me or my mother, my dad anymore. And I often wondered, you know, when does God kind of seal the mind and the heart of somebody? Even though their mind may deteriorate because of the damage that occurs in aging. At some point, God in His infinite wisdom knows when that takes place. And when we die, that spirit, what God has built, returns to God. Years ago, the church used to teach that was like kind of a memory stick, you know, that is inanimate, that God preserves to be united with a bigger and a better computer someday. You know, when the memory stick is plugged into the spirit body. Verse 8, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Everything's temporary. Only lasts for a while, and then it's gone. Now verse 13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments. What is most important at the end of the day? It's not what we collect. It's not what we do. It's not so much what we accomplish in this life in a physical sphere. What really counts is our relationship with God. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. For God, fear God rather, and keep His commandments. For this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. So what really counts at the end of the day in our lives? It's our relationship with God. Our relationship with God. Let's go to 1 Corinthians. I'd like to read some of the words of the Apostle Paul as he seems to have understood this as well as anybody in the New Testament writers. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 35. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 35. But someone will ask, how are the dead raised up? And with what body do they come? Foolish one, what you sow is not made alive unless it dies. We understand the cycle of life. We understand the fruit off of a tree falls to the ground. That fruit rots and deteriorates, but that seed goes into the earth, right? And then as the wind and the rain and even perhaps the debris from that fruit feed the seed, fertilize it, what happens? Soon another plant grows up. Nature itself, as Paul said, teaches us about these cycles of life and death. As you and I look around us today, we see a lot of trees without their leaves. It's the dead season, isn't it? But we know that when the spring comes, the buds will pop out, new leaves will appear, new fruit will come out, the cycle will be lifelike, and then come next fall when the fruit falls to the ground, the cycle repeats itself, doesn't it? He says we learn that from nature. Verse 37, what you sow, you do not sow that body that shall be, but mere grain, perhaps wheat or some other grain. But God gives the human body a body as He pleases. And to each seed its own body. All flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of animals, another of fish, another of birds. We're made in the image of God because God intended that we would be born into His family. There are also celestial bodies and terrestrial bodies, but the glory of the celestial is one. The glory of the terrestrial is another. There are beautiful things we see in the heavens that we admire, the stars, the galaxies. We look at the earth, we see beautiful things on the earth, and we admire those. And all those maintain some kind of cycle. Verse 41, there's one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, another glory of the stars, for one star differs from another star in glory. So also is the resurrection of the dead. The body is sown in corruption. It is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. There's a natural body and there's a spiritual body. And so it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. And by the resurrection and the pattern of Christ and by His power, you and I will be resurrected and given a spiritual body if we indeed die in this life. Let's notice verse 21, chapter 15. For since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. Talking about this contrast between Adam and Christ. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. But each one in his own order. Christ the first fruits, afterwards those who are Christ at his coming. Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom of God the Father, the kingdom to God the Father, when he puts an end to all rule and all authority and power, for he must reign till he has put all enemies under his feet. And the last enemy that will be destroyed is death. Make no mistake about it, death is an enemy. And this human body fights it to the last breath. It's amazing. You see people that are unconscious, lying in bed, and their human body just struggles and struggles and struggles to continue to live. It's what God built into us. It's the way we are. Let's go to Psalms chapter 90. Psalms 90. Verses 1 through 12. I'd like to conclude here. Psalms 90, 1 through 2. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Verse 2, Psalms 90. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you were there. God designed our earth to be perfect for our habitation. He designed this life to teach us lessons and for us to grow close to God. And to build that only relationship that will last forever, that is the relationship with Him. You are God. The Hebrew word is the ever-living one. By contrast to our temporary existence. Verse 3, you turn man to destruction. And you say, return, O children of men. 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it comes to the past. 1,000 years is like a day to God. Peter amplifies on this concept. Do you realize that a life of 50 years to God is like 1 hour and 5 minutes? Not very long in God's book. 75 years is less than 2 hours in God's time. It's like a watch in the night, says in verse 4. Verse 5, you carry them away like a flood. They are like sleep. In the morning, they are like grass which grows up. In the morning, it flourishes and grows, and the evening is cut down and withered. For we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we are terrified. You have set our iniquities before us, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. For all of our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh. The days of our lives are 70 years. And if by reason of strength they become 80, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow. You know, Linda and I live in a community of seniors, 55 plus community. They have a paper that comes out every Wednesday morning, and there was an article not too long ago in our local paper called the Rossmore News, and they announced that we have 25 members in our community that are over 100 years of age. And the article went on to claim that if you keep active in your senior years, you live longer on an average of 10 years. So they're, of course, trying to sell the concept of this senior community, that if you live in this community and we have 200 clubs and, you know, we have all kinds of facilities that you can keep active into your senior years, that that's one of the reasons of the longevity of these people. Well, a couple of issues later, they surveyed all the residents of our community and they asked them what the biggest issue was in their lives. What's the biggest problem you face? Residents, 6,000 apartments and homes. The biggest problem reported by far in that community was loneliness. Loneliness. We live to be 100 years old, and what happens? You're still lonely, even in a community of peers. That kind of struck me. He continues on. Verse 11, who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. And verse 12 is where I got the title for my sermon. So teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. What is the value of a death? Well, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes, he said, it's better to go to the house of mourning than it is to go to the house of feasting. What is the value? It is for us to reflect on our own lives and find out what's really important to us. What's most important to us? Is it our relationship with God? Or is it things? Or is it our anger that we can't let go of? Or is it other people? What's really important to us? Hopefully we have learned and do learn with the help of God's Spirit that what should be most important to us is our relationship with God. Because that's the only thing that will last. So in the shadow of the death of Dick King and others who have recently died and those who are near death is to teach us to number our days. And to find out what's really important in our heart and our mind.